Hi, this is Nancy Clare, and welcome to the special Christmas edition of Speaking of Mysteries. Our interview is with Christopher Fowler, creator of the Bryant and May series, the most recent of which, Bryant and May and the Bleeding Heart, was released earlier this month. Christopher Fowler was terrific, and the interview is long, so we'll get right to it. But I do want to mention that Speaking of Mysteries now has an opening and closing theme written by the incredibly talented Matteo Rader. Welcome to Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and for our Christmas special, we have Christopher Fowler, the creator of the Bryant and May series. His most recent is Bryant and May and the Bleeding Heart, which was released earlier in December. It seems that if there was ever going to be an investigative unit of any police force anywhere in the world called the Peculiar Crimes Unit, it could only be English and based in London. What inspired the PCU, and why at the dawn of the 21st century did two detectives, certainly past retirement age, seem like the perfect characters for a series?
Well, I think their time may have just come. They were in the back of my head for a very, very long time. And in fact, they first appeared in embryonic form in other books. As I tried them out, I thought it would be interesting. I'd always loved Golden Age fiction. I hadn't always loved the plots because the plots were often a little bit obvious and traditional. I mean, some of them were wonderful, and there was always a tinge of the class system and a certain amount of racism that went with it of the period. So there were elements of the Golden Age books I didn't like, and there was an idea in the back of my head: wouldn't it be intriguing to have an erudite detective in a modern world, rather than... I think it was also the time of... there were an awful lot of police procedurals which were very gritty and urban and angry, and I just want to step above that and have something a little more academic in the way that these characters thought. So that was the sort of basic idea behind them. And I kind of explored them a little bit, just really using them as background characters in a couple of books. And then because I do other books as well, and I pitched a book to my editor, and she said, forget it. This is like a terrible idea, and no one's ever going to like it because they're old. And I said, well, that's the point, you know, that they don't have to get into fights and you know, get into sexual conquests and all this. They can get into the meat and interesting things, or the things I would like to talk about, like London and history. And she said, no. Anyway, the publisher didn't go with it. So I left the publishing house and I went to Transworld, who loved the idea, and they commissioned the first two books.
And thank you to them. Of course, there's nothing like an editor saying no to be a red flag to a writer.
Oh boy.
Your Bryant and May series strikes me as very subversive in a very, very good way. Without getting all soapboxish, they do a pretty good job of decrying a headlong rush into modernization at the expense of being unique, of dwarfing cultural touchstones just to squeeze more offices in, and not just ignoring the past, but trying to obliterate it and become a ye olde London for the rich from all over the world. And that's a conscious part of the stories, I take it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a great nostalgist. This is the odd thing. I was born and raised in London, and I like the modernism that blurs into the old London. I mean, we don't have an old quarter. It's very unusual for a city as old as London. Most European cities, you know, they have an old quarter. And so that this kind of cramming together an old and the new has always appealed. But I did also feel I could use them a little bit as a soapbox for... they would have long memories. They would be able to remember what we had lost. And in a way, if we don't remember what we had lost, we're just going to repeat the same things and create the same problems. So it kind of gave me a really interesting angle on detectives with a bit of a social conscience, which is not something you get as much. I mean, I think you get an awful lot of stories about ex-alcoholic coppers with dead or ill wives, and there are too many archetypes. And I wanted to sort of have an archetype that was just so, well, I suppose more like me, really. but I modeled the two characters. I tend to always split my leads in novels into two people. And so I noticed here that I had very much the older part of me that wants to, that regrets seeing the things, certain things go, the quirkier things, to be replaced by the modernist elements of modern life. And at the same time, there's the, you know, I love technical stuff and I like the future. And I'm relatively early adopter on technical things. And so I could have that half of me reflected in the other character, May. And then when the two of them get together, then you get to see the sparks fly.
That's actually anticipates my next question. London is an ancient city, but the novels don't venerate the past. Bad things happened in the past, bad things are happening in the present. But what's fascinating to someone who lives in the New World like me, and I live in Los Angeles, and I did read your post about Los Angeles, is that some very high...
Well, I lived there, yes. I lived in L.A. from 79 to 84, I think. And it was not a great experience in my life because I was working in the film industry then. And it was a very tricky time for me. But, I did. It got a bit of a bad rap in a book I wrote about my time there called Film Freak. Although I have to say, I did. There was a chapter about the women of Los Angeles who worked harder than anyone I've ever met in my entire life and seemed to have to work twice as hard as the men in that period to
hasn't changed.
Be recognized.
It hasn't.
Oh, really?
Changed.
Oh, my admiration for them was boundless.
I love Arthur Bryant. I have a tremendous crush on him. And I think he's a testament to all that is worthy in the world of analog. And it's a joy to read his interactions with corporate speakers, such as Orion Banks, who tells a meeting of the union, I have to quote this, that she's bringing you up to speed on the public interface components of your skill sets, and that hopefully, with enough ambient management alignment, we can generate more interactive asset innovation. And the beautiful thing is, in your novels, analog wins every time. Is this a wish fulfillment?
Well, I think what it is that Bryant is always aware that time is getting short, so he cuts to the chase. He's like, yeah. What are you actually saying? which he does a lot. And he also cuts people short, but he actually pulls people up as well. So his boss, Raymond Land, who started off in the book as a bit of a milquetoast, has slowly started standing up for himself by taking Bryant's example. So I think he can also, you know, actually elevate people as well as dismiss them. And in fact, in the next book you get, I've teamed him with a child, and you'll see what happens in that situation. For someone who hates children and a kid who hates old people, how they rub off on each other.
And I wanted to say that stars of the celestial sort pop up a lot in this novel. Is that something that you meant to do, or am I overthinking, as I frequently do?
No, it's actually that's very it was a conscious thing. One of the problems with London is you hardly ever see stars. I mean, you just they're not here, and because there's a roof of cloud always over the city, and so the light above the city is yellow because it's reflecting on the bottom of the clouds, and so stars become impossibly exotic things that you cannot see in London. So it kind of started with the kids lying in the churchyard looking up at the sky on a rare night when you could see the stars. And it kind of slowly crept in with things from the name Orion Banks and through to the sort of punchline of the book, as it were, with the constellations being mentioned again. And this is something that seems to happen in each book I do. I start off with a particular theme, an angle, but another one gets generated along the way that seems to form itself as I develop the, I suppose, as I do the research, I start to find a particular area that crops up again and again, sort of topic. So I kind of end up exploring other things as I go along the way. So what tends to happen is my synopses that I deliver to my editor bear no resemblance at all to the finished book. So it's always a bit of a shock when they do receive a book and go, oh, you told us it was about X and it's about Z. And,
yeah, I was an editor for many, many years, and God bless you. And I finally had a T-shirt made, and I probably should have worn it, that just says a necessary evil, because that's how one writer described me.
That's harsh. I think a good editor is amazing. I mean, actually, my agent has always acted as a partial editor because she knows that I tend to overstuff things with ideas. And sometimes she says, you know, a book is an arrow that must hit its target. And so try to keep the arrow on course, which I think is good advice for a writer.
Another question about Arthur. In Brian and May and the Bleeding Heart, he has a psychological breakthrough that would be the triumph of any working therapist. Is he actually getting in touch with his feelings? Is Arthur evolving?
No, I think he's just actually managed to remember something.
Well, that's sort of comforting in a way.
I know a lot of academics, and one of the extraordinary things about them is that you kind of divine you divine things about them, even though they don't talk about themselves. They'll talk about, you'll get together and you'll talk about, I don't know, Pre-Raphaelite paintings or the works of D.H. Lawrence. But through it, you'll read something about them. And in a funny sort of way, the main characters, Brian and May, never really talk about themselves much, but you kind of get to learn about them more through what they're investigating in their accidental conversations. And I think that particular story that comes up in The Bleeding Heart took me by surprise, but in my head I always have his whole life mapped out, so I get to dip into it when it's needed, those memories.
But, you know, London has a very special place in these books, in this particular one, you really get into the disconnect between the city of visitors, the city someone like me might see, and the actual people that live there, the residents. And one in particular struck me when you were describing the Tower of London. You wrote, since 1066, the old fortress, protected by a moat and a river, had accrued purposes to become a complex of mismatched buildings set within the concentric rings of its defensive walls. It had been a place, a palace, a prison, a residence, an armory, a treasure house, a menagerie, a mint, and was now a box to tick off on the bucket list. Another World Heritage site to trot through in a couple of hours, squeezed in between a ride in the London Eye and a West End musical. Ouch! Are we that shallow?
No. I think what's happened is it's to do with the ease of mass migration. Right now in London, they allowed selfies to be taken next to paintings, which is something, this worldwide phenomenon in galleries now, where you have to queue to see a painting while somebody has a selfie of themselves with the Mona Lisa. It's because they want to show they were there with the painting. This is not about art appreciation anymore. It's about, I was there. So the pictures that get taken in the Tower of London, they're rather strange. That you have your picture taken with the warder, but you don't connect with its history. And in a way, the tourist attractions don't help themselves either by giving you more and more potted histories available. But one of the things that always surprised me about the Tower of London was that until the late 80s, you could stand in the middle of the green in Tower Square, and you could sense the past, because there was nothing taller than the edge of the tower in 360 degrees of your eye line. And now that eye line is bisected by all manner of banks and tower buildings, tower blocks. And so it lost something then, But nobody ever talks about that. It just suddenly happened, and now it's a peculiar little antique jewel box surrounded by big glass boxes. So I guess it's about looking at the bigger picture of, yeah, you can read your history about a building when you're researching a book like this, but equally you have to go and spend time in these places and see how people experience them now. And it's very different to even how I experienced them when I was a kid growing up. And I remember the first time walking into the Tower of London and being utterly awed by it and being shown it's this hushed room, you know, the crown jewels. Whereas now it's spotlit and there's a sort of conveyor belt thing where you go past them, and it's a different experience.
You know, if Shallow beats sort of the unfortunate combination towards the end of the book, I always want to be careful not to spoil when you're talking about your current book to introduce any spoilers. So I'm sort of dancing around the edges. So I hope you forgive me for that. But
I completely understand that, because I talk about the book. It's like, well, one of the weird things is that in each of the books, I try to cover a different kind of new age, golden age archetype. I didn't want them just to turn into a series of whodunits, because one of my problems with whodunits is that when you find out whodunit, kind of robs your interest in ever going back to that book. And in a way, it's rather reductive. And I rather like mysteries that you can never entirely fathom. I mean, they have to have a satisfaction level on what Marjorie Allingham used to call the plum pudding principle, which was that each few pages, the reader gets a plum. You get some pleasurable point in the book, and these build up to make something, a book you will keep and maybe come back to. And the danger with just writing, say, a whodunit, is a lot of them, once you know the ending, that's pretty much the book. So I've been slowly working my way through every possible kind of combination of, you know, golden age trope, really. And there's still so many to go. The more I read into that era, the more ideas from that time I'd like to pull up into the present day. So
I take it that Brian and May are going to be very, very long-lived.
Well, you could decide that at the end of the next book. My Reichenbach Falls moment is approaching.
No, say it ain't so. Can you hear my dog?
Yes, I can.
Towards the end of the book, you talk about some of the recent immigrants to London. And you describe them as having passed from barbarism to decadence without going through civilization. And is that a fairly commonly held feeling about some of your new neighbors, especially in South Kensington, I think?
In South Kensington, it's a particularly unusual situation. In fact, that in certain areas, in the moneyed areas, it's been that way since the 70s, whereby what happens is the newly rich come and they buy the 40-room mansion, and there's a spate of gold Ferraris knocking around one particular neighbourhood at the moment that take them to sort of having car races at 4 in the morning down the street. But that isn't my experience of the typical kind of immigrant experience in London, because I live next to King's Cross Station, which is one of the biggest, you know, well, it's probably the biggest crossing point in London. And so you'll hear hundreds of languages and you see hundreds of different types of people. And the one thing they always do is they learn the English habit of apologizing very quickly. No matter what language they speak, they soon learn how to say sorry if anybody steps in your path on the way to the tube station, which I find extraordinary. In that sense, everybody eventually becomes a Londoner.
So you mentioned your next book. So what can you tell me about Bryant and May and the Burning Man? And I take it this is not the Burning Man Festival that takes place in the Nevada desert out here.
No. This is a slightly earlier festival, which dates to Guy Fawkes blowing up, or attempting to blow up Parliament, and the peculiar British habit of celebrating a man who attempted to blow up government. And also because the festival is disappearing a little now in the UK. It's very, very close to Halloween, which is gaining prominence because Halloween is more of a merchandising possibility. And they're sort of the Guy Fawkes night, which was the night when you went out on the street with a dummy that you had built yourself and solicited money from passing strangers, is not so appealing to parents to let their children do anymore. So it's sort of vanishing. However, if you go to certain places outside of London, you'll still see it in full swing, and there are huge festivals that happen around the country. But the fire and insurrection chimed, when I was writing the book, it chimed with one of the big banking scandals and a riot breaking out in London. And London has always been, there's always been a certain amount of respect for King Mob, the mob rule, the mob voice. And I think that's changing. But so it made sense to coincide the idea of Guy Fawkes Night and the Night of Rebels with a real rebellion going on in London, London burning because of a banking scandal and rioters. So it concerns a young homeless man who gets caught between the rioters and the police, and of course a murderer.
And this,
that's all I'm telling you.
And this is because I noticed in this last book they have moved from working for the Met to the police force of the City of London. So does this work into that, their new bosses?
Yeah, it gives me a new set of people to play with. I like to ring the changes quite a bit on the staff lineup and on the way they work, because I can just, I like to try and wrong foot readers. I don't want people to go, oh, the series is getting a bit long in the tooth now, you know. There are plenty of, bless you.
Thank you.
There are plenty of series that, you know, run to 20 books, and you know, I don't really see, if I've got something still to say, I'm very happy to use them as my mouthpieces. So I'll happily keep running.
Well, we can only hope. But the PCU seems to have a fraught relationship with whoever they are part of, whether it's the Home Office, the Met, which I guess is part of the Home Office, or the police force of the City of London. They just really flummox their masters, and that's very wonderful, actually.
Well, I kind of think that the PCU, you know, it pretty much came from a real the idea of the units that were founded towards the end of the war, which my father was in one. He was in a science unit, experimental science unit. And these were very much real things set up with young men and women of about between 18 to 21. They were fresh out of school and college. They had yet to learn any disciplinary skills, and they were given a very free rein. There's a terrific book about them called Churchill's Wizards, and these are the young men and women who were brought in towards the end of the war to come up with crazy ideas. And for example, when they were looking for new ways of camouflaging aircraft and naval vessels, they didn't turn to the army to help them. They turned to the young artists of the Royal Academy to tell them how light works. And I like this idea of free thinking about solving a problem. So as I do have some moles in the Metropolitan Police, and they've said, of course, well, you know, it's not like that. We work on a very strict set of rules. So that's really why I had to create my own more experimental unit, and imagine that one of those units had continued unsullied to the present day. But that means that I can have fun with people trying to close them down all the time.
But there's no reason, or there's at the end of the day, they shouldn't, because they're actually incredibly effective.
One of the most extraordinary things I read about Churchill looking to find out what the Germans would do in the 1945 was he hired Dennis Wheatley, the horror writer Dennis Wheatley, to come up with a list of things that might happen at the end of the war. And Wheatley submitted a paper. And what's extraordinary, I read that paper at the British Library, and what's extraordinary is that a lot of the things he suggested actually did come through. Although I have to say that he was wrong about the French coming up with a death ray. I started off with a small but scarily loyal fan base. it's been very interesting watching people catch what I was trying to do. And getting on board with it, because I felt at the beginning I might be ploughing another lonely furrow on this one. I've done that a few times in the past with a few books.
Well, let me ask you a question. Obviously, you do this. Writers do this for a living. This is what you do to put bread on the table and a roof over your head and all of that sort of practical stuff. But I think that it might be more rewarding to have a fanatical fan base that gets you than wide acclaim that doesn't. Or am I just being
romantic? No, I think you're probably right, because I think one of the things is that you tend to if you start to think about how many people you're going to reach, You tend to bland yourself out, and the danger with that is then you're going to end up with something that's all things to all people. And if you're writing more to have fun yourself, then you don't start doing that, and you don't start limiting your options. And I seem to know an awful lot about American culture, because when I was a kid, you know, we always had American comics, and we had Mad Magazine and Cracked, and then at college I got obsessed with Watergate. I think I was probably the only kid I knew who read every single biography that came out of the Watergate scandal. So I think I even read Rosemary Woods's biography, and I certainly read Gordon Liddy's, and you end up with this sort of dual thing in your head of I always appreciated American society, but when I started the books, I figured that people there would know. I figured if they wanted to read something based from London, they'd know what I was talking about anyway. And if they didn't want to read, I think part of the pleasure of writing this kind of book is that you can kind of just nudge people's memories again. For example, last week in London, in England, the former Liberal leader, Jeremy Thorpe, died and got virtually no coverage. Now, I grew up with a Jeremy Thorpe scandal, when he was involved in a rent boy scandal, and the accusation, this is a man who reformed the Liberal Party and returned it into a reckonable power, and involved in a scandal that involved a hitman and killing someone's dog. It was a bizarre case that then the British establishment closed ranks around and closed and gently hid away, and he lived in quiet seclusion until he died this year. So that is another. I suppose that's our version of this convenient collective forgetfulness, which I kind of take pleasure in digging up again
and bringing back into the light. I read, you know, in preparation for this interview, I read your blog posts. I read your blog post specifically about being encouraged by the PR world to communicate about your product, which just saying that makes me sound a little like Orion Banks, I think. And I feel a little bit guilty about taking advantage of the situation. But how do you feel about writers establishing a brand? I mean, is that something writers really want to do?
I really don't think they want to do it at all. I think I mean, I've always believed that the writer's personality comes out through the page. If a good writer's personality always surfaces. I just read Hans Vallada's Alone in Berlin. And it's just an astonishing 700-page novel. And his tragic life comes through every page of that book. You don't need to really know much more, although it's actually quite interesting when you do read about it and find out his life was even more ghastly than his tragedies. But generally, I mean, a lot of the writers I meet do it for under sufferance. They do social media under sufferance. And it's partly because you are encouraged to create a brand for yourself and to market your books more and more. You get to do fewer and fewer book tours, for example. You don't get to do as many signings and readings, and you don't get to connect directly face-to-face with people like you used to. I mean, I do actually enjoy going out and doing... and I'll still go and do libraries and small, lots of small venues. If somebody local asks me, I'll always do a small local venue. Because the only way of really finding what people think is to talk to them for a while once they're relaxed with you, you know, and just to really sort of dig into what they like and why they like it. There is an old idea that says that any artistic endeavor has three points. It's a triangle. It's the creator, the art that is created, and the person who appreciates the created art. If you take away any one of those three points, it collapses. So I think you always need to be aware of your readership. But the idea of turning yourself into a brand is, it's very unappealing. I find it quite bothersome. But particularly when some writers take it way too much to heart. What they should be really concentrating on is writing good books and let somebody else find a way of, you know, not turning it into a brand, but letting it come out there. I'd rather the books surfaced and then the readers discover it, which is, you know, the way you discovered Harry Potter is the way that most people in Britain discovered it. It became a success by accident, not through the attempt to create a brand.
And other writers that I've... thank you for saying that, because with this... That's what I'm trying to do with this podcast. I want, using myself as a representative, which is probably really egomaniacal, but I wanted to let people hear writers talk about their work and what they're doing and how they feel about it. And some of the questions I ask are things like, you know, how do you feel about being a brand? And it's been refreshing. The answers, which are most writers resisted, and some have gone so far as to, you know, talk about the tyranny of a series, and how they
The tyrannical,
how they want to do other things, and they want to do standalones, and I'm thinking specifically of one writer, T. Jefferson Parker, who ended a series, and wrote a non-mystery, and now is writing a thriller that has nothing to do with his border series. And I can only, he didn't say anything because he's a very, very polite, very, very nice guy. But I bet his editors were kind of, and publishers were freaking out because those other books made them a lot of money.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a certain amount of, I think one should be aware of what readers enjoy. But I run several strands. So as well as the Brian Tomei books, I do quite a lot of standalone thrillers. And I have a chance to experiment with a smaller publishing house who lets me just go crazy and do what I like. So in the last couple of years, I've done four thrillers for them. And each one is extremely different to the one that's gone before. And some work, some don't. But I have the pleasure of working in a smaller environment for those and with a bigger playground for Bryant and May. Although, you know, nobody ever suggests what I'm supposed to do with a so-called brand, because I agree with you. I think it ultimately limits you. I mean, a friend of mine interviews writers, visiting writers here at the National Theatre, and she had to interview a very famous US writer who I won't name because I think it would be unfair. He was very charming in the green room before they went on stage and said, "While I'm on stage, I will be a different person, and I'm apologising in advance for who I will be." And when she went on stage, he blocked her questions and behaved the bad boy and refused to answer anything. And when he got back off afterwards, he said, "I'm sorry, but that was the persona I'm expected to deliver." And I thought that was kind of sad, because if you write yourself into that kind of corner, then the marketing is driving the creativity. I suppose the one good thing about being on social media a lot is you get to talk to an awful huge range of readers. And, you know, once you get over the politeness barrier with them and you get regular readers online, you can just end up, you've got a whole bunch of sounding boards out there. You know, they're giving you advice and ideas and bouncing around crazy stuff. And I think it makes writers more accessible. So I think from that point of view, I mean, I really enjoy being on social media, as long as we can all have a good chat.
Social media does do that. It does give you a connection with people from all over the world. You probably get to hear from readers in Australia, New Zealand, and English-speaking readers everywhere.
Canadians are very vociferous. I have more Canadian commenters than anything else. I don't know why. But the English are quite reticent, and also there's a sort of casualness with English readers. You get an awful lot of people say, "Oh, you write those, do you?" "Yeah, well, I like some of them. You know, others were boring." You know, they're very blasé. They're probably more like East Coasters. I don't know. But,
well,
it's nice to talk to people, though.
It's one last question.
It's very sweet. Yeah.
This is our Christmas special episode, you are, to my knowledge, the only writer who's been on Speaking of Mysteries who's written a Christmas carol or jingle. And wait for the question. Do you have opinion on what is the worst Christmas song that's played during the season? The one that will make you grind your teeth and abandon the long line that you've endured almost to the till, just to escape?
Well, it is, but I don't know what it's called. It's based on some horrible kind of Cornish folk song, and it seems to have sort of kazoos in it or some equally ghastly instrument. And it was redone by a pop band in the 70s, and every darn year, it turns up on the radio constantly, and it has a sort of rumpty-tumpty Morris dancing kind of sing-along sound to it that I can hear in my head right now.
But, sorry.
sorry.
I said I'm sorry.
It's awful. It's kind of, imagine the worst kind of accordion and kazoo folk dancing song, and then stick treacly Christmas words over it. So, I mean, I actually stick to that. I go back to the Phil Spector Christmas album. I think I'd rather have that.
Brilliant.
Do They Know It's Christmas is a pretty horrible one.
Yes, when you hear The Wall of Sound and Frosty the Snowman with The Wall of Sound, you know it's really Christmas.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you so much for doing this. I really, really appreciate it. I hope it wasn't...
It's a great pleasure. I'm just sitting here in Barcelona. They've just put all the Christmas lights on the building opposite. It's very beautiful. It's all sparkling. I live right next to a concert hall. And the kids will be out in the streets later with fireworks and drums, which was what they tend to do for any event here. It's cake, fireworks, drums. So that's what makes Christmas this year.
Well, thank you very much. It sounds great. Thank you so much for doing this, and Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. And I can't wait for the next Brighton May.
Well, March 26th, it comes out in the UK. I'm not sure what the date is in the US, but it's that near.
I'm marking
fact,
it down.
Yeah, I'm supposed to.
I'm marking it
down. Cool. Well, Merry Christmas to you, Nancy.
Merry Christmas.
Thanks very much.
Okay, bye.
Okay, bye.